Welcome to the Joe Cohen Show. Join me as I share my experience with biohacking and invite top health experts to explore the latest technology, supplements, research, and resources for optimizing your body and brain.
Hey everyone, I'm here with Lauren and Renee Sambataro, who grew up in a health-driven family that prioritized the fundamentals of wellness and self-care. Their father, Gene Sambataro, the original biohacker and pioneer of holistic dentistry, taught them the importance of individualization, curiosity, and experimentation from a very young age. Coming together as health entrepreneurs, they are a certified nutritional consultant and holistic lifestyle coach with a master's degree in nutrition. As well, Lauren Sambataro was a former Broadway performer, functional diagnostic nutrition practitioner, and exercise coach as well. And it seems like they know about microdosing prep, which could be interesting as well. They have a passion to share their journeys about wellness, and they also know a fair bit about personalized health, and they use lab work and different kinds of testing to personalize people's regimens when they do their coaching. So thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having us, Joe. It's good to see you. Been a little bit.
Yeah, likewise. Okay, so take us through what happens when you get a client. What kind of lab tests are you typically getting the client to do?
Oh, great. I love that you started with that because most people just skip right over the lab testing. And I think there's just so much like juiciness we can get from just your basic CBC, CMPs. I'm definitely of the mindset, like, I want to make my coaching cost effective for clients. Renee does too. And we could just right out of the get-go just run like all the fancy functional lab tests because it's awesome and information is very cool. But most clients come with at least like their annual blood work from their doctor. And this is not new to your audience, but it's very common to hear my labs are normal. And if you're having symptoms, they're just brushed aside. So what we love to do is just look a little bit deeper in that first session, see what we can gather about just like some basic foundational lifestyle principles like your digestion, your electrolytes, your adrenals, just basic nutrients, your liver detoxification, inflammation. There's just so much that gleans that you can start working on like today, right now, rather than waiting to speak to a doctor or waiting for a particular protocol or a medication or going on some, we could talk about when elimination diets may be helpful, but we can start feeling the benefits of this stuff today. And that's something that we find is just so overlooked with traditional medicine. Amazing benefits there. But I love basic blood chem because it's like a puzzle. We're putting together these pieces that almost always correlate with how someone is feeling. And they go, oh my gosh, I didn't realize that's what that meant. Or I didn't know that's why I was feeling that way. And great, you just gave me actionables that I can start doing today, such as chewing our food a little bit more, which seems like so simplistic. But how many people, and like for your audience who's listening right now, can you be really honest and tell me that you're chewing your food 30 times? Probably not. I barely do it. There's some things that we've just got so caught up in with our modern day, very busy lifestyles that we can really just come back to the basics with blood chemistry alone. And then I think it's like endless what we can do with the lab work, but we start with the basics.
That's cool. And so when you're looking at a CBC and CMP, what are some specific things that you're looking for? Like, give me, if you can, specific examples of what you might see that's wrong and what that might indicate.
Sure. One, I just want to check that they look hydrated so we could see that from their minerals like sodium, potassium. I want to check what comes up quite frequently and maybe not always correlated with symptoms is digestive dysfunction. So we're looking at like protein total, the globulins, albumin. We can see a little bit in the liver enzymes if they're not like digesting and then moving food through their body well. And so just as I mentioned before, the basics of just chewing before we jump to like pulling in HCL or digestive enzymes or doing a gut protocol, which most people need, but we have to do the basics first. So definitely looking at digestive function and just looking at like basic HPA access. So like adrenals and hypothyroid through the electrolytes, glucose, but we could dive into that. It's just a snapshot in time. Sometimes it's revealing, sometimes it's really not. Sometimes Renee has great stories. Her glucose on her lab work looks perfect. And then we put in the CGM and we see these variations or aberrations from normal. And it's, oh, we could look a little bit deeper and get more information there.
Yeah, it's interesting. I actually have the opposite right now, whereas my blood sugar with a CGM and the HbA1c is very good, but my fasting seems to come up higher. I think it's because of niacin, but it's not like super high, but it's usually around 100. And
your waking glucose?
Yeah.
Glucose. Yeah, the waking is interesting too, because that tends to stress people out. They wake up, they're like, oh my God, my glucose is rising. But in some cases, we actually want it to rise because it pairs well with cortisol. And like cortisol during the daytime is good. It's anti-inflammatory. It's anabolic. Like it's not a bad thing to have that rise. But are we pouring fuel on the fire by drinking coffee first thing in the morning? Are we starting our daytime with like screens and going right into beta productivity mode? Is it just high stress? That's like the interesting nuances that we can glean from something like a CGM, where we can just make these micro adjustments.
In terms, going back to digestion, you're saying that you'll see there's a digestive issue if somebody's albumin is lower or total protein is lower?
Yeah, I would say the globulins and the protein total are probably going to take a hit first. You can see lack of stomach acid or just like general digestive inflammation generally. So then you go, do you have symptoms? Some people say yes.
Okay.
Some people say no. And then the question is, for the people that say no, what do we do? Because it's so much harder to connect a protocol or an actionable when there isn't a symptom. And Renee has some great tricks for that. Like, how do we actually motivate people to do those things if they're not showing up in their lab work? But as a practitioner, we're seeing the signs and the trends that it could use some support. I think this really falls into the genetic report world. Like, we're reading these things because we want to prevent disease and we want to optimize. So we're living in that gray area where maybe there aren't like some gross, like really annoying symptoms, but we want to optimize. So how do we bridge the gap there?
That's interesting. In terms of, so for me, my total protein, I don't know if you know this offhand, most people don't know the numbers offhand, but my total protein is a little bit suboptimal lately.
Low or high?
A little low. It's normal, but I would say, so the serum total protein is around like 6.4.
Yeah, it's a little low.
It is a little low, right? Or it varies. It went to 6.8, but still it was on the lower side. And I thought it was because of digestion. So I started taking a lot of digestive enzymes and also HCL and different things like that. Didn't help it, actually. What did help it was just taking in more protein for me. I just think I use up tons of protein with exercise. So
yeah.
I'm curious. And also if I'm fighting an infection, which in the winter, there was a lot of infections going around. I think my body was just using up a lot of protein.
Sure. But yeah. Your
I'm
body's going
to
use.
Distinguish that.
It's interesting with the lab work, because I think in traditional medicine, it's like low means X, high means X. But in functional medicine, when we look through this wider range, it's, oh my gosh, there's so many possibilities. Like, we go from a 50-piece puzzle to a 2,000-piece puzzle. So there's more possibilities. So a low protein may not be low stomach acid. Low protein could be low amino acids, or it could be low B vitamins. So we have to get to know you and figure out, like, what's right for you. And then there's some intelligent experimentation, like, can we just test and see, do you feel better with this? Ooh, this is fun. But yeah. We love amino acids. I'd be curious about that. Renee is, like, huge on aminos.
I'm pretty big on aminos as well. I could show you all my aminos, but essentially, as you could see here, right, it was lower in October 19th, 2023.
I love how much data you have. This is amazing. Yeah, impressive.
It February 6th to 6.0, also January 14th to 6.88. So it's almost 6.9 and then 6.666. And I can verify if I have an infection based on my serum iron levels. So if it's mine are under 70, I know I'm fighting an infection.
You have your ferritin as well to go with that?
Yeah. So my ferritin is usually more stable than the iron. It doesn't fluctuate as much.
Yeah.
Do you see anything else, maybe blood biomarkers or even like heart rate variability when you're fighting something?
Absolutely. There's tons of metrics, actually. So I'm just showing you one, but I've counted like probably 60 different metrics that I could measure that I could show you how it changes. Iron is just the most stable one.
Yeah. I wonder if you're in our camp where we believe like getting sick is not a terrible thing. Like it's a hormetic stressor. It actually maybe creates more resilience if you have the recovery time on the other side. But this is so cool to see the dynamics of your body over time because your body has innate healing mechanisms and probably a lot of this healed on its own. Interesting that your ferritin is so stable, but not the iron. So I would maybe, I'd be curious to talk to you about your, what you know about your genetics, but I wonder if it's more of a B vitamin or a vitamin C cofactor.
It was at a certain point, different, there were different periods wherein, and then I made sure to titrate my B vitamin dosage. So now they're always at a high level. In.
Do you want to hear about the one health hack that is sure to change your life? Okay, here it is. Subscribing to this podcast. 67% of listeners aren't subscribed to the show, so please don't forget to show your support by hitting the subscribe button now. You'll not only be supporting the show, but also investing in yourself and your health journey, all while helping to keep us ad-free.
Which amino acids were you curious about?
I actually was just talking generally about your amino acids, but you, take them and you test them.
I do, yes, absolutely.
You take them every day?
Do I take amino acids or do I test them every day?
Hopefully you don't test them every day.
Yeah. Do you take like a like an EAA blend every day?
I don't do an EAA blend. So basically the reason I don't is because we put on a lot of information on Self-Decode about all the amino acids, and you probably haven't seen it because it's been the past 2 weeks, unless you're looking every day. But essentially, yeah, there's a lot of information. And so me and my team were doing research and adding information. And one of the things, if you look at the research, one of the things that consistently comes out is having higher isoleucine in the blood is associated with higher mortality. So lower longevity, essentially. And my isoleucine is usually pretty damn good. Like, it's definitely not low. It's not high, but it's not low. Whereas my leucine sometimes was low. I don't want more isoleucine, and I want more leucine and valine because those are actually associated with lower mortality.
Yeah. So from a dietary perspective, how do you approach that? Because I know, are you mostly carnivore?
I have a none of the above diet right now. I basically...
the best kind. None of the above.
Yeah, I just do. I just follow exactly what my lab markers tell me to do. And it's nothing to do with any kind of diet. I eat one meal in the day and the rest are shakes and concoctions based on stuff that's going to improve my lab markers.
Yeah, I'm not really familiar with these ranges or like the absorption of it. So I'm excited to dig into what you put up on the website. It's very cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. Interesting. Okay. So this is all through food, not supplementation and interviewing you and your podcast stuff. How do you feel about the supplemental, like BCAAs versus EAAs? Or are you just purely food supplementation?
So I don't take EAAs because I don't want the isoleucine. But yeah, I also don't want certain amino acids. So the certain amino acids that either I have enough of that are in the essential amino acids, the EAAs, and I don't want all the BCAAs. I find that if I just take in enough essential, like if I take in enough whey protein, and I have very high protein needs. I think my body just takes, my muscles just soak up amino acids. That's what I think it is. That's why I don't have any
How much protein are you consuming in a day? On
I need 200 grams of protein a day often, right?
And And what's your body weight?
176 pounds.
Okay. It's a little over 1-to-1.
Yeah. It's about 1-to-1. Let's just say I need 1-to-1. Okay.
Okay.
I need one. But I need it. If I don't have it, you're going to see like amino acids be lower. So that's really cool that you guys do all these measurements with the amino acids, because I only started doing the amino acids. How long have you been looking at amino acids for?
So we're not testing aminos, but I just see some clues in the blood chemistry. And because you mentioned to me that you don't think you have low stomach acid digestive dysfunction, then I think the next option is usually there's something with the aminos. So it's more like a possibility. Like we don't get clear cut black and white answers with the blood chem. It's like a puzzle. So we like start to put it together. We talk to someone's experience or their symptoms. And that's what we're trying to do. Be health detectives as best as we can. And a lot of it is dictated by you, right? Like it's your health. It's your body. So you're running the show. And your intuitive experience is very meaningful. And I think because we work with men and women, but predominantly women who are naturally a little bit more intuitive, but in this day and age have been disconnected from that. And that could just be from environmental stressors ruining gut health, but also because we haven't been given the space to listen to our bodies. So we really have to allow for this conversation to get people to have permission to listen to their bodies. Like, you are very clear. This feels good to me, so I'm going to do that. I'm like, yes, that's true. You have to honor that.
I would like, actually, I don't know if you want to do this. Would you like to look at my blood chemistry? I'm curious what your ideas are for that.
Sure.
What you would be seeing.
Can.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Cool.
And Renee, please jump in.
Yeah.
Anytime. Well,
this is really Lauren's specialty.
No, so, by the way, I'm doing this because, look, I think I know a ton about this stuff, but I'm not arrogant to think that other people don't know a lot. And it seems like you guys do know a lot. That's why I actually don't ask a lot of people to do this. Almost nobody. It's a very good compliment.
Oh, thank you. And a test. Let's see what we find.
It's not a test. No, it's very clear when you were talking about it that you're very intelligent about these things.
I call Lauren my blood work ninja. She's a ninja.
I just find it so fascinating. It's so fascinating to
me. I'm going to be your toughest client, though, because everything you tell me, you're going to probably tell me to do, I probably do it right.
Probably. I feel like what I'm gaining or understanding from you is maybe even do less. Like, you have so much information and you are such a chemist. But like, at the end of the day, you get to decide. But when Renee and I work with clients, we're trying to get people to trust their body's own natural healing abilities. And I think sometimes I'm not talking about you specifically, but a lot of people will meddle too much. Oh my God, this is out. I got to fix it immediately, rather than trusting the body's dynamic process and natural healing abilities. If we can account for all the other stressors, of course, environmental stressors, air quality, water quality, do you have heavy metals? If all of that is accounted for, our body should be able to take care of this stuff, ideally.
Right. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, let's start with it. The B12 comes up as high. It's because I'm taking B12. What would you say about that?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't really pay attention
Forget
to
it.
That. I would want to look at your methylmalonic acid. If you're
My
taking B12, I feel like
good.
It's not really that valuable. Someone could argue that, but
I would agree with that.
Yeah, it looks good to me. Yeah, so I wouldn't put too much weight into the B12. I would look probably more at like your CBC, like corpuscular volume. But this is, so you're on your CMP. So let's go through. Your blood urea nitrogen is high because you eat a ton of protein.
That's right.
And your cystatin C is okay. So I'm not really concerned about that. Yeah.
But yeah.
So I just mean, like, I'm not concerned about your bun because it's not your kidneys. I'm assuming you're an optimized human. So you're hydrated. You know a lot about electrolytes and absorption.
Yep.
I'm just going to assume
I'm well hydrated. You can look at it. No need to assume. What do you want to look at? My sodium or?
Yeah,
calcium?
Let's look at your electrolytes, your CO2, your calcium.
Here's my sodium.
Yeah, and so you see, like, over time, it, like, waves a little bit, which is normal, right? Like, our body's dynamic.
Yeah.
It's going to shift up and down, but you're staying within the range. And this is the beauty of having so much data. Some people only test once a year. Some people test twice a year. And so if they have one deviation, it's, oh, my God, something's wrong. Well, with you, we see, oh, no, it's just naturally going to change a little bit, and that's totally fine.
Yeah, so one of the things that I tended at certain points to be lower on is chloride, which I just fixed by taking more salt, I like eating olives. And now what I do is I actually take potassium and magnesium chloride. So I get a lot more chloride.
Okay.
But it's been also decent since I've just been eating more salt as well.
Okay. Is it possible that you ever overhydrated?
In
terms
of
water lover?
Salt?
I would say water volume.
Yes. Yes and no. But basically, the more water I drink, the more salt I consume as well.
Okay, it feels pretty balanced.
And same with potassium, meaning I don't think it's an issue drinking a lot of water as long as you're taking in the salt and potassium. Do you agree with
that? Yes, I agree with that. I was only asking, some people are just, I feel like the brain cues around thirst are not always linked up with actual cellular hydration. And there are people that will just guzzle water without the electrical charge. So they're actually, it creates a sense of overhydration, which could maybe potentially drive down the chloride, but
so here's one
about your stomach acid. Ooh, amylase, very fun.
Yeah, this is one that I'm actually a little stumped by. So, it's, you know, it actually was normal for quite a while, and then it elevated. I'm not sure if it was from the infections or just from the, it seems like it's just increasing the more I increase my protein intake.
Yeah, I would wonder, like, what really is the sweet spot for your protein? And all of these ones that are out of range are happening in February around that infection that you keep mentioning. So I would just be curious to wait and watch. Like, I think that's a good rule sometimes is just wait and watch. I know you want to be the most optimal version of yourself, but I'd be curious what your body naturally does. Because at some point there's going to be a cap on protein, right? Like, you're not going to just keep increasing your protein consumption. I'm curious about your glucose.
Yeah, go ahead. The glucose. I'll show you with the glucose. So my HbA1c is good. And also,
what's your A1c?
When I put on 5.3.
Yeah.
Good.
This one is because of these two, I think, are because of the infection. And this one as well. So these were, this is no infection, right? So 92.
Yeah. But what about below? Like November, October?
Below,
September
I think this
year.
Was from, this was from niacin, I think.
Yeah, I'm just always, it's such a snapshot in time, which is why we always tell people to wear a CGM, because I'm like, is this white coat syndrome? Is it a supplement timing issue? Is it
my CGM
too
was
much
good.
Cortisol?
Yeah, my CGM was good. I wore it for 2 weeks, and then it was like in the 90s most of the time.
All the
even
time?
Even after meals. Yeah, even after
Were
meals.
Pretty flat? Like a flat line?
Yeah, it was pretty flat. Unless I ate a lot of junk food, but otherwise it's pretty flat.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's what I'm curious about. Are we aiming for a flat line, or do we really want that smooth rolling hill kitty roller coaster?
It would be a little bit. It would be like slight bumps, but it really depends on if I ate carbs or not. If I ate some carbs, it would go up a little more.
Sure.
Yeah. So it would be less
flat.
And
overnight, was it pretty steady overnight while you're sleeping?
Yeah. Pretty steady.
Yeah.
Yeah, because that's the one that people don't see in the labs, right? The overnight. I see a lot of clients with a reversed trend where daytime is super stable. They're like, I got the food, perfect. But overnight is a disaster if you're dealing with an infection or mold or maybe sleep apnea. So that's where I think like lab tests are great. And then we have to expand the scope when we see when there is a curiosity.
Right. Do you ever do mold testing?
Yes. Actually, a lot of the clients that come to both of us, if they suspect mold, they're probably already seeing 5 other people. I'm rarely like the first person to bring that to their attention. But if it hasn't been done, we'll run it. We're also like really suspect about the heavy metals because our dad's a biological dentist and we're just seeing so many connections to metabolic health. And it shows up in the lab work, it shows up in sleep data, it shows up in HRV, and that seems to be like a pretty overlooked. Like, I feel like a lot of people are talking about mold. Not enough people are talking about the heavy metals at this point. It just in
Are you looking
experience.
At a chelation challenge or the, just the serum heavy metals?
So
I read the tri-test from Quiksilver Scientific because it's looking at hair, blood, and urine and then comparing the ratios. So I feel like it gives us a better idea of is there an acute exposure? Was there an exposure a long time ago? Is your body holding on to it? Is it excreting it? I think the chelation test can be good too, but I just tend to do the tri-test.
Oh, that makes sense.
And the chelation challenge may not be right for everyone because if you're super toxic, you don't want them to be more sick because we just were trying to gather information. So I guess we have to be discerning when we choose that.
I find that my heavy metals in the blood went down quite significantly recently.
Yeah. What did you do?
But did you look at hair and urine too, or just blood?
Just blood.
Yeah.
I mean,
ideally you don't want heavy metals in your blood at all, right? The body should be getting it out of the blood, but then it's storing it typically. It loves going up into the brain, redistributing. But what did you do to get it lower in the blood?
I just took MSM mainly and also spirulina.
Negative effects of the spirulina? Did you do any chlorella or just the spirulina?
Yeah, spirulina and chlorella. I think they have similar effects.
Yeah.
Any negative effects? No, not that I can tell.
Yeah, I think that's a good sign. Some people have really terrible effects.
Like
chlorella, like in a sick, metabolically ill body, could just create all kinds of chaos. But
why would that be?
I think it just starts pulling stuff and it could be too rapid, similar to the chelation challenge. You don't want to just provoke in a really metabolically unstable body. You want to ease into it.
Yeah, I've never been susceptible to heavy metals. Even when my lead was higher, I didn't really feel anything.
I think that is pretty common with heavy metals. I think because it can show up in so many different ways, right? It could be GI issues, it could be chronic fatigue, brain fog, skin rashes, right? Because it can be so many different things. People don't always connect it. Like for me, I had mercury levels off the charts.
In the serum?
Actually, it was the tri-test that I did. It was the blood, hair, urine. But what was interesting was it found high levels in my body, but that I wasn't excreting it. I'm like, my body was holding on to the mercury, which is really important to know because that would change how you detox. And so actually, there's an interesting story. They, I think 30 years ago, the American Dental Association did this test on dentists to see what their mercury levels were, and they tested their hair. And across the board, it was pretty low mercury in their hair. So they said, we told you mercury is not a problem for dentists. We proved you wrong, kind of thing. But actually, they found that these dentists were so toxic, they were holding on, their body was holding on to the mercury and wasn't excreting it through the hair. So looking at just hair is not a good solution.
Yeah. That's where the provocation can really help. But again, I got to be like gentle about who you're doing that to.
I find it really interesting that tri-test, because when I think about it, I think the most accurate, the most relevant is the serum levels, because that's what they're doing the research on. So we don't really understand, meaning everybody's exposed to lead. For let's say if I did a test on lead, I'm sure my results would be that you'd find higher levels in the urine because I'm excreting out a bunch of lead. And
which
that's actually
a good thing.
Yeah, exactly. Meaning my lead levels are going down. Because I must be excreting him out more. So you would be, you do a urine test, you're like, oh, this guy's super high in lead or whatnot. And it's, I'm just detoxing it better.
And that's a problem with the mycotoxin test too. Like a lot of the mycotox profiles are just urine. It's like, oh my God, it's coming out. Yay. Congratulations. It's coming out. Good.
Yeah. If it's not coming out, then that's when you have a real problem because you're storing it. Yeah. And exactly. We see that a lot with autistic children, actually. Urine, blood won't really see much, but they're just retaining it, which is very problematic.
Yeah. And then the hair, I think, okay, if I had high lead, it would just be, are you next to a coal plant or something like that, right? Or is there an environmental source of lead? I think that's probably going to be the biggest impact on, if you think about it. Yeah. I wonder how they're doing these tests, but in the air, there's lead. And it's probably just a function of where you are. So if I'm doing a lot of these tests in India, there's probably going to be a fair bit of lead in my hair.
Definitely.
Yeah. And aluminum. Aluminum, cadmium, mercury, arsenic. I think we're seeing it across the board because our environment is just filled with all these toxins.
Yeah. So that's why I think the serum levels are just the best. I found that my serum levels are very, like, they go down as I detox more, as my body is much better at detoxing. And I actually didn't target it specifically so much. It was more just like I targeted other things. And then that was just one of the positive side effects of having better detox abilities.
Yeah. Your body should be able to detoxify if you're slowing down the inputs and it's coming into a healthy body for sure. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah,
but I agree with you, like testing the blood, because if that's the gold standard in research, then we just want to look at consistent data, right? You're not going to compare your blood to your urine the next time and then your hair. You're just going to keep testing the same thing. We want to look at the same, we don't read the story through the same language, essentially.
So what else do you like to test?
Yeah, so I do a ton of glucose coaching, like CGMs with people. And Renee's really passionate about HRV testing. I think we can really glean a lot from that. Like, how are we recovering? Because everybody wants to know, like, how much am I supposed to exercise? How much am I supposed to sleep? Like, how much of everything? And let's get feedback from the body. So I love the lab testing, but it is a snapshot in time. I think we can zoom out a little bit better with things like the CGM or HRV testing. And we've used the Hanu strap, which they're a little newer, but there's some cool data to watch trends just throughout the day, because most of the wearables are giving you the overnight HRV snapshot or something like Apple that's completely random. But Renee can speak to HRV.
Yeah.
Yeah. Go
for it. Yeah. I think seeing what's going on, obviously overnight and looking at your HRV while you're sleeping is really helpful. But during the day, too, just to see how recording a podcast impacts your HRV or going to do a high intensity workout or a cold plunge or a sauna. I think this should be like the gold standard for biohackers to determine how much they can handle and how quickly they can recover And Lauren and I are on this mission to help women discover their path in biohacking, just because we do need to biohack so differently than men. For men, and Joe, you probably see this, you can probably fast, you can do an OMAD, you could do cold plunge, and your HRV probably bounces back much faster than it would for a female. And so rather than women trying to just follow what Joe's doing today or what Dave Asprey's doing today, tuning in and seeing, okay, when I did that, this is how long it took my HRV to bounce back. And then just exploring all the hormetic stressors and looking at that recovery, I think, is so helpful.
I was going to mention cycle syncing. Like, if we are really trying to personalize for women, people, like, cycle syncing is all the rage for good reason. It's personalizing. But cycle syncing has to be nuanced even further. Like, you can't just Google, what days am I supposed to do hard workouts? What days am I supposed to detox? We also have to pair that subjectively with feedback from listening to your body. Renee and I were talking earlier. She's, according to cycle syncing, I shouldn't be strong in the second week of my cycle, or I should be stronger, but actually I'm stronger in the first week. So, like, how do we actually keep listening to our body rather than seeking answers outside of us, which applies to everyone. It applies to men and women across the board.
So how do you, what's your best ways to increase HRV? I actually find that for me, the number one way to increase my HRV at this stage is to work out less.
Yeah,
that's a good one.
It is a very good one.
Number one is avoiding alcohol. That's the best way to help your HRV. So, yeah.
I agree. That's why I conditioned at this stage, because I'm not drinking alcohol. Meaning, if I was drinking, that would probably be number one. Yeah, that's a good one.
Yeah. So, for someone that wants to improve HRV, I would say, number one, cut out alcohol if you haven't already. Number two, look at your workouts. Like, how often do you do high intensity? And then three, really optimizing your sleep and whatever that means to you, because it's going to be different for everyone. But yeah, if I do those three things, my HRV is like insane.
Yeah.
What is your HRV?
Hers is freakishly high.
Yeah. My average is 145.
Oh, that is very high.
Yeah. The other day I just saw 203. But, I haven't had
alcohol. Which higher is not always better, but relative.
Okay. Yeah, you can't compare to other people, because HRV is such a personal number. You really want to look at your baseline, and whether your baseline is 10 or 150, that's fine, but it's the variation. So if your baseline is, say it's 50, what does it take for you to get that 50 to be a 90? Like, through breath work, through sleep optimization, all the things. And then when your 50 baseline drops down to a 10, what the heck did you do? So that variation is where you can really learn from your personal number. So yeah, you don't want to compare to other people.
Yeah. Though I would say 10 is probably not good, but I was just going through HRV data with my client this morning, and she's really solidly committed to her exercise routine right now. But we were looking at the impact of endurance versus high intensity versus her yoga day. And she had these two big spikes. And I was like, what did you do that day and that day? One was a yin yoga class. And then the other day, she did acupuncture and took a day off from her exercise, and her HRV skyrocketed. We do need these stressors through exercise, but the HRV really responds if you get the stressor and then recover. It's the same for glucose metabolism. It's the same for looking at labs. So we got to do a little bit of stress, and we got to go hands off. Let the body do what it needs to do.
For me, the number one thing is just is not exercising.
Resting.
Yeah.
But I used to have the opposite problem where I didn't exercise much. And actually, it was healthier in a lot of ways.
What do you do?
I think it's all
now,
like, the balance. Goldilocks knew what was up.
Yeah. I guess it is a balance. So, like, my previous regimen was, like, I would play volleyball on the weekend. So, get a lot of exercise on the weekend. Nice. During the week, I would just do some walks and, like, a little bit of push-ups. But, like, a lot of walking. And walking is, like, very light on the body. No injuries. You know what I'm saying? Had adequate time to recover from the weekend where I played 6 hours of volleyball a day. And that was my... And then I guess there were different periods, but that was my previous thing that I did. I was just doing mainly walking, push-up here and there, but nothing significant. Now I got into Acro Yoga. And like the other day I was just exercising for 4 hours. It was 3 hours in Acro Yoga, and then I was doing an hour of bike riding. It was just like, before you know it, it's 4 hours of exercise. And I don't know. I don't want to do less of it now. So I don't know. I'm But I realize that when I take a day off of Acro Yoga or just I only go for a walk that day or something very light, my HRV skyrockets.
Yeah.
Might just be the timing of it, right?
Yeah.
Timing.
Finding the right balance. I think finding the right balance between it. Maybe you do the Acro Yoga day and then you have a walking day and you alternate.
So that's, yeah, I don't know. Then on the other hand, the more fit you are, the better your VO2 max, the more muscle mass you have. That's also associated with longevity. So the question then becomes, do you want a higher HRV or do you want a higher VO2 max or be more fit physically?
Yeah, I guess it depends, like how much stress and how much work do you have to put in to get that ultimate VO2? Can you really maintain a 45 VO2 if you're like crushing it at the gym all the time and your HRV is going down? There's going to be like a little bit of compromise somewhere. And I still think it's like a Goldilocks, like somewhere in the middle, because we know bodybuilders who have a crazy amount of muscle mass are not necessarily fitter. That's a more intense burden on the cardiovascular system. So yes, we want muscle. We don't want no muscle. What's the right balance for you? And like joy and enjoyment is really important.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Have you tested your HRV during an Acro Yoga session?
Yeah. And I'm not saying my HRV is low. So let's just for context, it's if I'm like very careful with my workouts, meaning I just do the minimum I need, it's going to be 100. That's my baseline.
Great.
Yeah.
That's my average. Whereas if I do a lot of exercise, it's going to go down to mid 80s. So it's not a huge difference, maybe a 15% decline. Mm-hmm. And yeah, so right now my HRV is, and I'm trying to see ways that I can get it up while doing this amount of exercise. That's like a goal that I have now,
to
see how high I can get it with keeping my current load.
Yeah.
Have you done
You do want variability within the variability, right? We want it to move. We don't want it to, 100 is great. Of course, we're not supposed to compare to people, but generally 100 sounds pretty good. But you don't want it to be 100 every single day. You don't want it to be stuck because that's not resilience.
I would push back a little bit about comparing it to people because there is data that shows lower all-cause mortality with higher HRV.
Oh, with high, so, too high.
No.
Yeah,
the
lower
is worse. Higher is better.
Yes, agreed.
Now, that doesn't mean that astronomically high is the best or whatever, right? I want to look at that data. I haven't looked at it recently. What range of HRV is the lowest all-cause mortality?
Ooh, I don't know. I'm curious. Yeah. I was more just arguing because I have higher HRV as well. Mine's like 105, 110 average. People will go, oh my God, you're so healthy, your HRV. I'm like, that doesn't necessarily mean that we have to only compare it to ourselves. But yes, if your HRV is 10, I would be concerned. If it's 20, I'm like,
we
need to work on this.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I actually think it's a testament to that you guys are very healthy. Meaning let's put it this way. It is possible for someone to be very healthy with 60, something like that.
Right? Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I would say if I haven't seen that many people, like very few people have 100 and are unhealthy.
I would agree.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I would agree. Just trying to get people out of the comparison game.
Yeah. Yeah, just that you can't compare it.
I kind of like the comparison.
This is biohacking. Let's do. I know.
My competitive nature. I'm just like, no, let's compare.
Yeah, that's so fair.
You got better markers than me.
Yeah, that's so fair. We only bring it up because we work with women and we just find there's so much. We get into this narrative, like negative narrative sometimes with the comparison. So we just need to reset, be like, we're not comparing to anybody but you right now, right? It's like gentle medicine.
No, I think
but for the biohackers, let's go.
Yeah.
It's very helpful to tell them that because you don't want people to freak out. It's like a sport though for me. Just like if you're losing, you don't want to be like angry about it. It's still fun to lose. So that's how I see it. I don't mind if I'm losing in a certain area. It's just it's still fun to play and if somebody's better, I'm like, okay, how do I beat them?
Yeah, how do I do that?
Yeah, how do I do that?
I agree.
Yeah.
But I don't think I'm going to go to. Yeah, I'm not going to 200.
For
That's
sure.
That's not happening.
We should have the HRV Olympics, like the aging. What is it? The Rejuvenation Olympics?
Yeah.
Yeah, this the HRV Olympics. Exactly. Yeah.
I think mine would go down, though, because I would be stressed about winning, and, like, stress is terrible for HRV.
Yeah, I don't know. Have you guys done the aging test, the epigenetic aging test?
Yeah, I've done a couple of them.
Yeah, True Diagnostics, all over the place.
Let's hear it.
I was 15 on one, and then I was 41 on one. I was 41 True Diagnostic.
Oh, okay. Interesting.
But what was interesting with that test, so that I was 41 with my biological age, but the Dunedin pace of aging, I was 0.7.
My pace was 0.8. I'm trying to slow that down even more, but I'm happy with that.
Yeah. I think the other thing is the biological age. I don't know about you guys, but that's including what you did in college. Like the binge drinking in college that I did definitely impacted my epigenetic methylation versus my pace of aging is all the biohacks I'm doing now and that I have been doing the past few years. So at 37, I'm healthier than I was when I was probably 22.
How many times have you taken that test, the pace of aging?
I've only done that one once.
Once.
Because the other ones like tally age, age rate, glycan age, they don't do the pace of aging. What about you?
Yeah, I've done one methylation test, but a while ago, and that's also I was a little younger than my biological age, and I don't remember the name of that even, to be honest. But the True Diagnostic one, I got 0.63 as my pace of aging.
Nice,
very
that's
nice.
Great. You and Brian Johnson.
Well, Brian Johnson is 0.69.
Oh, he's 6'9". Oh, I thought he was point. Yeah.
No.
Him.
He's 0.6. Yeah.
Nice.
I don't get it.
I'm gonna take another test so that I get into that Rejuve Olympics. Yeah. So I'm gonna do one more of those. But yeah, Sim has done three and he's been waiting 4 months to get in there.
His? Can you share? Or is that?
Yeah, he's public about it. So
okay.
He took three of them. One was like 0.62, one 0.65, I think, and one 0.69. So his average is 0.66 or whatever it is, 0.65. I don't know the exact number.
Now I want to retest because I've been doing some new things in the last year since I tested. So
how would you improve digestion, let's say? What other things might you do that I didn't mention?
With men, I'm always talking to them about how fast they're eating and like what they're doing while they're eating. Are you truly in rest digest when you sit down to a meal? And how long does it take you to digest? But I'm sure the basics that you're already doing, like not drinking too many fluids while you're eating, using bitters if that works for you.
I probably do drink a fair bit of fluids, though. That could be the issue. But and also I drink two of my meals, so they're shakes.
So it's like chewing your smoothies if you can, which feels ridiculous.
I chew gum after a lot of times. I do a fair bit of chewing with the chewing gum.
Yeah. I always sprinkling something crunchy on top of my shakes if I'm going to do a drinkable nutrients just so I start to produce the digestive enzymes ahead of consuming it. Mm. But yeah, gum's an interesting strategy. I'm not against the gum. We're just always thinking. Yeah. So because our dad's a biological dentist and he looks at airway structures and with like modern foods, there's just so much our ancestors didn't drink smoothies, right? Like they had really strong bone structures because they were constantly chewing and using their jaw. So what happens when we transition to just drinking our nutrients with not just the digestive enzymes, it's the structure of your jaw as well. But it's also like the best way to get nutrients. You can shove everything into a smoothie. So I'm a big fan.
No, that's a good point. In some ways, the smoothies are better because you're breaking it down.
Yeah. Right?
You don't need to digest as well. It's broken down already.
Yeah.
But still, you want to get that level of stomach acidity that you would get from chewing. And also, I'm taking a lot of digestive enzymes, so I don't need that.
Gum, that's pretty intense on your jaw. And it's really like the neuromuscular connection. Like we know that the more teeth you lose, the greater risk of dementia goes up.
Mm.
So again, I think the chewing gum can signal really important things to the brain.
Yeah, it's brain health too. I don't know. We're going to stay in touch with you. I want to hear about your bun levels for the next couple of months.
Yeah, I'm going to be... My bun is... It's always been elevated for years.
I'm not concerned with it, but I know you want to be perfect. So I'm like,
No, yeah. I'm curious if there's anything that it could be I'm just missing something with the metabolic pathway of why it's, again, it's also muscle mass. The more muscle mass you have, the higher your bun is going to be as well.
Oh, yeah. That's why I don't think like 25 is not bad. But yeah, I would just see if chewing a little bit more, or I don't know if there's any other like window into your gut health that you could reinvestigate, re-explore. Are you doing any spore biotics? What's your probiotic?
Yeah, I do. I do a lot of, like, I do some spore probiotics. I do.
Are you doing it with your meals? Will you have it with your shake?
Both.
Yeah.
Yeah, what? Mainly with the meals, actually. Yeah, mainly with.
Yeah, it's better with.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I do the spore. I have a whole list of, like, I take L-reuteri. Like, I know there's, I actually know, I've done megadosing experiments with every isolated probiotic out there. And so I know which ones are good for my gut, and I stick with those.
Awesome. What functional labs are you looking into?
That's what I want to, I'm looking into also which ones to look into.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
I would just I'm a big fan of the Dutch test. And if you haven't done organic acids, I think that's interesting, especially if you've looked at your toxin levels.
Yeah. So the organic acids is on top of the list just because it's like the number one test with functional medicine practitioners.
Mm-hmm.
And I haven't ever done that, actually, just because I don't think there's as much data as other things.
There isn't. It is a little experimental, but it's interesting.
I'm curious, actually, for the organic acid, which markers are you looking at and what do you find the most interesting?
Oh, gosh. And there's just like a million possibilities. But I think the fungal markers are probably the most interesting on there. Glean a lot about like antioxidant status. And like, do you have enough glutathione? Is that working for you? I would say those are like the two big takeaways a lot of the times is are we really dealing with fungal overgrowth? Because we get like some indications of that on blood chemistry, but I think it's much more telling with the oat. And I love the neurotransmitter section. There are some companies like, I think Microbiome Labs is doing like the whole genome sequencing, which tends to be a little more accurate, where most of the stool tests are just the 16S PCR. I don't know. It's really hard to speak to the validation because we don't have the years of research like we do with blood chemistry, but I think we can at least, like, for some people that need that evidence, if someone's really struggling, sometimes it is the piece of evidence and the motivation we need to proceed with a particular protocol. Is it 100% accurate? I don't know. Probably not. We have trillions of bacteria. Yeah. It really is not. Again, I agree with you. And the blood is the most validated. So I just don't ever agree with functional practitioners that are running these like right out of the gate. I think there's like a time and a place for it. And then we have to really use discernment as we look at them.
I could see a Dutch test being useful because it's also continuous, right? They're seeing like over 24 hours, how much hormones you're peeing out.
Yeah, they're usually 4 or 5 point tests because you do the 5 point cortisol. And then I think you get at least 4 points of hormones across the day. Yeah. So you're getting a dynamic rhythm. Think, yeah.
Yeah. So that's actually, that makes sense to me. Okay. Also, it's not as good as necessarily serum, I think, but it's very difficult to do the serum throughout the day.
And we're not seeing the metabolites. We're not seeing how the hormones are being metabolized. That's a whole other area of information that's really useful. And I do find the Dutch really correlates quite often to someone's symptoms or complaints that they're having. It's so useful. Yeah. If we just suspect that there is like an HPA axis dysfunction, or if they're dealing with PCOS, endometriosis, if they have some kind of cancer, maybe breast cancer diagnosis, or maybe they're scared about their BRCA gene and they want more information, like definitely so many applications for women. I agree. It's maybe less useful for men.
Are you doing it for men?
I will, but I have run probably like 10 times the number on women than I have men.
Okay. Yeah. So one of the tests that I was doing a lot of research on, you know, myself and clients, whatever, was the food IgG test. And that I came away with that it's complete bullshit.
If you're eating something quite frequently, you're probably going to develop an antibody, right? And if you have an IgG, an IgE that's high, you probably know it because you probably feel like shit when you eat XYZ.
Yeah. Yeah. I would agree with that. That's all it shows is like what you're eating.
I think also just if you have leaky gut, intestinal permeability, you're going to see a ton of foods. Like I would have some people come back and they're like, I'm sensitive to 40 foods. I'm like, well, if the food is not the problem, your gut is the problem. So then we just go through a gut healing protocol, which we could have just done that and saved the $250 on the test. Yeah. I will share one interesting client story where the IgG test did help. This is a rare case, but it was interesting. She came to me and she's like, I cleaned up my diet 3 months ago and I'm feeling worse. I'm tired. I have brain fog. I have gut issues. I have the skin rash. I'm like, okay, let's run the IgG test. This is 13 years ago when the testing was like really new and exciting. And it came back and almonds were off the charts. She had switched everything to almonds, almond butter, almond milk, almond ice cream, all the stuff. Because she was cleaning up her diet. She was doing what she was told to do, right? And the second we cut out almonds, 3 days later, all of her symptoms were gone. And maybe I could have pinpointed down that it was almonds with looking at food journals and food stuff journal. Like that. Yeah. But just that quick, we solved all of her problems.
What I think happened there is that you were able to see from the test that she was eating a lot of almonds.
Yes, and, which a food journal probably would have showed.
Double confirmation.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then from there, I think it could be, and I'm saying as playing devil's advocate, that broken clock is right twice a day. So you're going to have people sensitive to almonds, and happened to be she was one of those people.
Yeah.
And she was eating a lot of almonds. And so I could,
that's
fine. I could see that being useful. The problem is that every time you tell somebody to do something, if you miss, it becomes like it's a problem. You don't want to miss in things because then they start losing compliance if you're they're missing.
Yeah.
If it's like, try this, try that, try this. So as a test, I don't know. That's my goal now is I want to try to be a detective on these functional medicine tests and see what's bullshit and what's not. I haven't been getting clear answers from people. So tell me just as the last thing, I'm curious about this GI map. What are you looking for in a GI map?
Making sure that page one is not a disaster because that's the most important page. Let me pull one up. But do you have one, Nays? So the first page will go through the bacterial overgrowth, but I like to look at patterns and trends. So similar to blood chemistry, I'm looking for patterns that there is like digestive dysfunction or inflammation. There's different kind of patterns that we can learn through like diagnostic solutions as some great education around that. So I really love page one. And I also love the last page, which has like your pancreatic enzymes. It'll have the inflammatory markers. It'll have anti-gliadin. So for someone that really needs that kick in the butt to get the gluten out of their diet, that's helpful. We can look at zonulin, marker of inflammation.
Leaky gut.
And leaky gut. You have one to pull up?
So ones do you find, based on your experience, is like the most relevant? You look at that and you're like, okay. And then do you retest it and see if it normalizes when you do certain things?
I would say always check in with symptoms. Not that symptoms are like the end all be all, because we can have issues and not have symptoms. But typically when a GI map is really messy, you will have someone with symptoms. And so it's similar, I would say similar to tracking like SIBO. If you're getting progression in the right direction of symptoms, then we go off of that first. And then we can just discern and assess, do we need to retest? I always think retesting is great. People don't always have the money for it. So start with the symptoms and then knowing that it is like a little bit of a shot in the dark. So you may get a retest that looks totally different or maybe it looks worse because your microbiome is changing all the time. And who knows that we got like the right sample A to compare to sample B. So I'm looking at like really big variations. And again, like page one, I think the last page, the digestive markers and the inflammatory markers are probably the most useful.
Have you taken these tests in a healthy state? Because one of the reasons I want to take these tests now is because I find that I'm in a very healthy state. And if I see a bunch of random mold markers coming up or like fungal markers, I'm going to start thinking like, I don't know about this. Because then it means that in very healthy people, you could also have these things come up, which puts a question mark around it, right?
I have. Yeah. Like very low symptoms, seemingly nothing going on. Yeah. I can remember a time I did one. I was healthy and I'm trying to remember, like, a handful, but I've had the anti-gliadin come back high. So I was like, oh, okay, I gotta be more careful about gluten. Definitely like some digestive inflammation, even though I wasn't feeling it. And then I've had the opposite where, like, recently I suspected I had H. pylori and I did an endoscopy and it came back negative. And I was like super suspicious because I went on a PPI like short term and I was like, you're not supposed to test that when you're on a PPI. Of course, it's a false negative. So then I went and did a GI test, H. pylori. I was like so sure I had it. And the GI map came back negative. Is that enough information for me to confirm? I don't know, but it was two tests back to back that said no. So I've had both where I feel good and things pop up, or I suspect something and nothing comes up. I don't know that answers your question because still, do we really know? Yeah. That's why I just think like your intuition is so important. And a lot of people are just so desperate for answers that they just completely stop listening to their body. And I'm not saying that's you. You sound very intuitive, but it's a lot of people that come to us. And when we really give space and ask that question over and over again, what do you intuitively feel is either the challenge or what is the right path for you? They already know the answers. We don't need the test. But some people need that extra confirmation. Yeah. To confirm the intuition. That's like the number one. If we can get in touch with our intuition, I think in most cases, that's all that we need. And yeah, the microbiome testing, I think there's just so much we don't know about microbiome and a shot in the dark, especially with a one day 16 PCR test is who knows. But if it comes back and there's stuff that's revealed and then the client goes, oh, you know what? Actually, I didn't tell you before, but I am experiencing this. Then you're like, okay, that makes sense. Sometimes it's not going to. Sometimes it will.
But I've never seen a GI map come back perfect on anyone, even Matic. So I think no matter what, it's giving us some guidance of, one, we need to make a change, two, what direction to go in, and then three, like we were saying, that motivation of, like, even just like gliadin IgA, like, people are so funny about giving up gluten, and then you show them that off the charts, and they finally are like, okay, I'm going to do it, and they get rid of the gluten. That's just one marker.
Appreciate you guys coming on to chat. Where can people find you?
Our website is thebiohackerbabes.com, and we hang out on Instagram a lot, or biohacker_babes. And then we have our personal handles, which you can find there. And our podcast, The Biohacker Babes, releases every Monday, and you'll be back on shortly. And yeah, we appreciate the opportunity. It was fun chatting with you.
Yeah, likewise.
67% of listeners aren't following the show. So please don't forget to show your support by hitting the follow button now. You'll not only be supporting the show, but also investing in yourself and your health journey, all while helping to keep us ad-free.